One, two.
Jack, can you turn up that handheld? Yeah, can you turn it up there? Yeah, just so it matches the volume level of this. I think this table might be a little bit too loud, considering there's going to be 15 people. Yeah, that's better. And you turn that handheld up, though? Okay. Do you want audio, Ben? Okay.
One, two.
Oh, really?
One, two.
One, two, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Is the volume level the same for her mic as it is for this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Right. Right.
One, two. Oh, it's still there.
One, two. Not, it's not as. One, two. They don't need much.
Thank you.
Okay, people are going to sit over here on the right side, panels are over here. The middle seat. This building I feel very comfortable. Hi. You don't mind me helping on this side of my head. Hi, are you here?
Yeah, I'm okay.
One, two.
This is an intense experience. I should get on my limited survey of one, that it's the same exact problem. Which leads me to look forward.
I have my office.
I'm sorry, if I can see you're behind here.
Okay.
Hi,
Your Honor,
come
home.
Hi, Your Honor.
Can I get through?
Yeah. Nice to meet you.
Hi, Jim Michaels. Nice to meet you.
Don't adopt it.
Go get some notes.
Don't get it. It's. I don't know why we adopted it.
Every other licensed professional has it.
How much do you have to pay for it? Every other state. Or New York has it now, too. That's recent, though.
No worries. Well, it's not required. I'm not sure if they don't get something from this, particularly if they're worried.
What does
the criminal area, you want to make sure the defense attorneys are up on the guidelines.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain things.
I think it's just a general appreciation that Massachusetts is trying to keep up on developments
Yeah, right.
Better than most states.
Yeah, right.
I actually, it can go. I actually do kind of enjoy it. What we're supposed to do? Having a clue. I have no idea.
Are people asking us questions from like Oz, or is it?
No, it's probably.
It'll be kind of like the Gretchen Walsh program, Little Duck Comes to Ask.
Yeah, broadcast. You betcha live.
It's
yeah.
A secret world.
This is broadcasting now.
Live broadcast. People who subscribe. Those are the separate people that they.
So I'm very judicious.
Yes, judicious. And this may be shown again at some later date.
And some of your colleagues may be.
That's right.
No,
no.
The lesson of the chapter was it will be transcribed, put in a database, and counsel will quote you back certain things that you say.
Well, I started seeing from your counsel.
Black criminal law.
Black, I know. Black criminal.
I think that's maybe. I'm sitting here wondering on any of these people in front of me as we speak.
I don't have that problem. Did you perform your mission? Good man.
These chairs are really weird, aren't they? I like to kind of move around.
Have you started doing it?
Oh yeah, we have started the ball.
We're just. I thought the yin and yang short. I thought daughter, who's 12, always got everything in check. She's fully organized. She wants
something.
She's on the book. She's a medium. And then I've got a son who we don't know Saturday morning whether we're going to pick him up at school Saturday. We don't know much too far in advance of plan. Jill Connors, his general theory about it is if he has some money, he's on the book. It's sort of guiding theory. Colleges are just getting his grades. He's got four AP exams and AP calculus.
Yeah, that's been from the book here.
English and history. What's the theme on today?
My daughter was a.
We don't have that goal and understanding it.
And of course, knew the.
She was a lawyer?
College. Yeah. The lawyer here on Dora knew that.
Is she still there?
No, she left. She went in house with a little company called Avid out in Huxford. But she knew that guy. I didn't.
George
actually. Yeah. She had worked for him. So.
Oh, she actually worked for him.
Yeah, she knew it. Not for anything. No, not unrelated.
I think generally, if I zoom correctly, they might have experience and quite limited. But I can tell you that once you get a little bit of college or graduate student, you're going to do the same thing in your life with minor variation.
No, it's just a chance.
Thank you.
spread this one out. Yeah, we'll spread them out a little bit. You guys could probably share that one. We can share this one.
Tell us something online, so I don't see anything embarrassing.
Is that true?
I remember very just the day.
Yeah, like one, stop talking then.
It's not true.
No red lights come on or anything?
Yeah, they tried best they can within, you know, the minute of the range. And I think it is true.
Well, I think that maybe
it's really nobody has it back up.
I'm told. I mean, one of my young lawyers working on this. I tried this yesterday to watch something else that he did, and he said, I mean, you actually see him.
Really?
So somebody's out there watching
this. Fancy biggest. I'm out there. I'm sorry.
And specifically, I'm talking to those of my friends that are out there that I talk on online, there may be more of you, but hello Larry and Vince and John, and who else have we got titled?
Well, we have Austin here,
and we have
Jennifer Baker, and Johnson.
Jennifer.
Lauren Collins.
Hello, hello. welcome to Digital Discovery. This is an event of the Berkman Center. We're hoping this develops into something more. This is a planning session today for what we hope will become a series of different conferences and a CLE online offering on digital discovery. We have met with a wonderful group over lunch and talked about planning issues and a little bit about substance. And we're now meeting here to talk through the substantive issues, many of which you contributed by your online contributions to. That's what I have from here. So let me ask our panelists if they would introduce themselves. Gianna, would you start us off?
Hello again. John Jessam, CEO of Electronic Evidence Discovery.
And now, just so that we get it straight here, John appeared in my evidence class as a digital discovery expert, we think 8 years ago. So you've been in the business quite a while.
That's right. Yeah, going on 14 years now, actually. Yes.
14 years. Jim.
Jim Michaelowicz from DuPont, the manager of litigation support, also the manager of legal services. I've been with DuPont for almost 10 years.
So give us an idea of what you actually do
here. I manage, we have a program called the DuPont Legal Model, in which we've narrowed down our law firms to 38 and also 7 service providers. So I manage the resources that handle our litigation. And one of those areas is now electronic discovery in particular. So we've come up with a program what I call more of a response program, so we developed, and still a developing program, so I'm responsible for that program.
And DuPont obviously is a far-flung entity.
International, absolutely. We're a law firm, we're a law department with 140 attorneys.
Great. Steve?
I'm Steve Hyman. I'm Deputy Chief of the Criminal Division of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston and a computer crimes prosecutor. Deputy Chief of the Criminal Division, I supervise the 80 or so assistants to conduct all of our criminal cases. And as a computer crimes prosecutor, I was the first in the country to do a court-authorized wiretap of a computer network. It happened to be Harvard's computer network. And also, I think up until the denial of service attacks on Yahoo, the only prosecutor to have prosecuted somebody who actually affected our infrastructure with a computer attack, which was a juvenile who took out the control tower at one of our regional airports.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Judge Saris.
I'm Patty Saris. I'm a United States District Court judge for the District of Massachusetts. Before that, I served on the Superior Court of Massachusetts for 4 years in the trial court. And before that, I was a United States Magistrate judge for 4 years. My real claim to fame is that I learned trial practice from Professor Nesson in 1975, and he takes all credit for my my trial abilities. But I will also say that I know a lot about the discovery process, but the digital discovery issues are just beginning to hit the federal courts, and I look forward to sharing with everybody here information about it.
Great.
Tom.
I'm Tom Allman. I'm the general counsel of BSF Corporation, and I have responsibilities for, among other things, worrying about litigation and worrying about how a large corporation, which is part of an international corporation, can deal with digital issues. Prior to joining BASF in 1993, I was a trial attorney with Tassett, Tennis & Hollister, a large firm in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I'm a graduate of the Yale Law School from about the same generation as you folks.
Great. Thanks, Tom.
I'm Terry Lenzner. I'm an attorney, graduated from this law school in 1964, and am now chairman of the Investigative Group International.
What does that mean, you're chairman? That means you run it, basically, right?
Well, I run it along with the chief operating officer is Larry Potts, the former deputy director of the FBI, so I would say he really runs it with me.
And give us a sense of what your business is.
It ranges from domestic and international due diligence, civil litigation, support, white-collar crime, defense, anti-competitive practices, counterfeit goods, market manipulation on the Internet by various parties. It's a very far-ranging, worldwide investigative research operation.
Is it true, as I read somewhere, that you were President Clinton's private investigator?
My company was retained by Bob Bennett of Skadden Arps and Williams and Connolly, and their client was President Clinton.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Would you pass the mic to Kevin?
Sure. My name is Kevin Conway. I'm a Boston attorney. I have a small law firm, Conway, Crowley & Homer. We represent plaintiffs in personal injury cases and people who have been injured by vaccines. I actually know very little about digital discovery, for those of you who out there that can empathize with me. But I do bring some things to this conference with me today. I bring a lot of experience in the law, working for both a plaintiff's attorney and defense attorney, working for both corporations and for people. And I also bring with me a concern that the wave of technology is going to somehow inhibit justice and inhibit my clients from finding out the truth. And so that's what I bring here today.
All right. Well, we're here in a classroom at Harvard Law School with a few students who are working with me on this project and with some guests as well that include Ken Withers from the Federal Judicial Center, Rich Kilberg from Fred Friendly Seminars, and the rest of the people that you see here are part of the Digital Discovery eLab group. Over to my left, your right, sitting in a place where you probably can't see her, but nonetheless you're in touch with her, is Talia Milgram Elcott, who is our online moderator and the chief honcho of the ongoing Digital Discovery Project. And so with that, let's get started. Our purpose here and our endeavor is to look at the main subjects, review them with the panel, and then go to your questions about them, and then come back and do it again. So our program is to continue in this mode until 4:30 this afternoon, and at that time I hope we will have mined the subjects in ways that are interesting and useful and give us a start towards the future of our project. Kevin, let me start with you. We're interested in the subject to start off of the cost and the scope of discovery, digital discovery. In a typical case, and you're a typical plaintiff's lawyer, what are you going to ask for?
Well, there's two sides to cost. One side is the plaintiff's cost for producing information requested by the other side. Typically, in my cases, that will be a very small cost. It will not really be an issue. If a but I am going to ask for all of the information that, that has typically been asked for in other cases, when all of the documents were traditionally kept in files and paper documents. And documents which, you know, which are, I believe, are relevant to the case. So I'm going to ask for relevant documents. I'm not going to try and be overly burdensome. I'm not going to try and be disruptive to the defense. But I want relevant documents that are going to help me prove this case. And it seems to me that cost has always been an issue. But with the extraordinary cost of paper, and the cost of paper is extraordinary, this is, it's almost like a miracle for defendants now to save money. And they can now produce all this information at a fraction of the cost that they could just a few years ago. So I think cost is something which is a legal term used by people who don't want to give information, terms used to fool judges, and I don't think it's an issue. I don't think cost is an issue unless the system set up to hide discovery are so intricate that when they are ordered, it's going to put them out of business.
All right, Jim, the ball is thrown to you. He says cost is it's a blessing for you, digital discovery. You're on the defendant's side. You're in a lawsuit against Kevin. You've received a discovery request, and you should be happy about this.
Regis, I thought we were going to start with a $100 question. I didn't think we were going to start with this one right away. Kevin, I appreciate your thinking that the electronic age has helped us so much. I come up with a very simple grid as far as costs and what I would say the burden of the cost on a corporation defending a litigation and what I think you may need to pay for in this case. There's active email accounts. That is something which I feel that I have the responsibility to be able to capture and to review those, and I feel that we can bear the cost for that. When you get into backup tapes for email, I think we're going to start drawing the line, because I really don't feel that what you're requesting is in the same kind of mode that the active email accounts. I had to spend about $1,000 maybe at a person's account just to restore that information so I can look through something, which I don't think is going to be anything more than what you've already got with the active email accounts. So my feeling is that if I've got a well-structured corporate records program in which my backups are there for disaster recovery and it's for 2 weeks, I think as far as paying for what I think could be a fishing expedition, I think that in that case you should be paying for the cost for that.
John Jessen, would you give us a little primer on what's there in Jim's company? That is, what could Kevin go after if he wanted to go after it? How big is the pot, the information that he could try and delve into?
John, is somebody engage you this thing?
Well, that's one. I mean, that is one of the issues everyone's dealing with today, because there are so many different variables. It's very easy to think of electronic discovery as email, but it goes well beyond that. There's word processing documents, there are databases, there are spreadsheets, there are graphics, there are login files, there are files that were formally deleted and are partially available. Unlike paper, which either exists or it doesn't, electronic data exists in so many different formats. Literally, we find on average when we get a data set from a company to look at, there's probably in the neighborhood of 300 to 500 different formats of data that are in that media set. And it can be a very small media set and still have 300 to 500 different kinds of information in it.
300 to 500?
300 to 500 identifiably different types of data, each of which has to be interpreted properly, each of which has to be restored properly to maintain the integrity and authenticity, and each of which has to be then displayed properly so that you can rationally view it the way the user may have. So it does put a tremendous burden on an organization to have to go back through, especially legacy data, historical data, and to start restoring it, especially backup tapes. Then you, not only do you have to worry about data types on backup tapes, but you start looking back at more than a couple of years, and do you even have the backup tape anymore, the drive that wrote the tape? Do you still have the software? Was there a password put on it that maybe somebody forgot? Tapes tend to deteriorate if they're not kept properly. I mean, a whole host of issues start to arise when you start talking about duplicative data that goes back over time.
Could you take the 300 to 500 data types and articulate them so that there was a checklist we could actually go down them, and Kevin could say, I want these, I don't want those?
You bet. And that's often a very good way to approach this type of discovery. I think there, any way that you can exclude information that may, you know, that just isn't reasonably relevant, I think it's important, and especially in the electronic area where you can get so much volume. I mean, we have a client we're working with that generates 52 million emails a week. When you start talking about volumes like that, if you don't have ways to cull out information, it really gets to be problematic. So yes, one very good way is to make a list and say, you know, there's no way this kind of file could contain data. Get rid of it. In this particular type of action, there's no way that this data type has anything you're interested in. We agree to remove it from the table and to walk through a list like that. And backup tapes, since they are mostly, they're temporal and they are duplicative in terms of having redundant data, you can also apply statistical processes to eliminate tapes. So if you have a set of 1,000 tapes, all from the same machine, temporally oriented, you can actually go through and eliminate 90% of those tapes without losing very much information at all, a few percentage points. So things like that can be done to make it more rational.
Tom, all I've talked about is backup. He's depositing 1,000 backup tapes. First of all, tell us how these backup tapes get generated. Why do we have 1,000 backup tapes?
I hope you don't have 1,000 backup tapes. You really shouldn't in a well-managed system. The purpose of a backup tape is simply to back up the information so that if you lose the primary source of information, you can reconstruct it. And our IT or information technology or IS, information services technology people, are constantly obsessed with the idea that they're going to be held personally responsible if the server crashes and that information is gone and a vice president the next day wants to have his emails back. So for some period of time, you need to have a picture of what was on that particular group of servers, and you need to hold on to that until you're certain that you can safely move on. And that's what a backup tape is, but that's the sole purpose of a backup tape, to reconstruct, not to be the record or of the event in question. And so one of the issues that one has to ask oneself is whether or not in the rule itself, in Rule 34, for example, where they talk about what a document is, did they really have in mind things like backup tapes, which were not intended to create records for operational use?
So you're making a decision then between information that's kept just in case of a disaster, so you can reconstitute the information base of the company, and information that's kept for purposes of retrieval for some other purpose.
That's one distinction I'm making. Another distinction might be the way in which backup tapes are kept. Their information is thrown together without any way of retrieving it. It's not labeled. It's not logically put together. It might consist of 4,000 people putting information on one backup tape, as opposed to the way information ought to be organized, which is with appropriate ways of retrieving it. If I understand things correctly, and John's the expert, not me, but you simply cannot take a backup tape, stick it on a machine, and go through it and search for things. You've got to reformat it, put it in a searchable format. And this is what takes hundreds of hours and an incredible amount of work. And if you apply a statistical analysis, throw in the distinction that you just articulated, you wonder, can this really have been what the framers of Rule 34 had in mind?
So, Kevin, back to you. Are you willing to say we don't have to have those backup tapes? They were just kept for disaster purposes. We're happy with them getting the information that the company kept for retrieval purposes.
Well, it all depends on what they've given me. You know, if I think there are key documents which for some reason are on the backup tapes and in no place else, then I certainly want those backup tapes. You know, my suggestion is that they hire a couple of plaintiff's attorneys and help them design a system where you can file things that may eventually be the subject of discovery in the future. Design the system, put them all into neat little categories, and the other 98% of the stuff you have, you can do what you will with. My problem is that there is a suspicion from my skeptical profession that the immensity of the system is by design, and that the more critical the document that I need, the more likely that it's going to be found in some immense system that is far too costly and burdensome to unravel.
So, Tom, talk to him.
Sir, no, I would argue that I understand his concern, and I've heard talk that we should not presume there's a presumption of good faith, so I will not operate on a presumption of good faith. But I will say this, that if you were to say that for good cause shown, you could make an exception to the principle I'm articulating, which is that only matters which are kept in the ordinary course of business are subject to electronic discovery. You could then, for example, in his case, posit an example of where he has some reason to believe that someone has deleted something, that deleted email might have been captured on a backup tape. I can see a situation where we might have to deal with that issue, and therefore, unless the tapes were disposed of in the course of a neutral management system that routinely disposed of tapes, which is another subject we should talk about, then I could see that maybe we should reconstruct that particular backup tape or backup tapes for him, and we would be willing to do that.
Judge Sarris, be a judge. You've got the excuse
here. Well, here I am. I'm at the Rule 16 scheduling conference. This is where the dispute will first comes to me, and you're both supposed to have turned over automatic disclosure, both under Massachusetts rules and soon to be under national federal rules. You have to turn over or describe all relevant information. So have you talked 2 weeks before the scheduling conference? Have you shared what exists and what doesn't exist and prioritized?
No, we have talked, and we have a difference of opinion as to what's covered by the rule.
Well, worse than that, in all reality, Your Honor, is that we frankly didn't think about this and didn't even really get into this in our initial conference.
All right. Well, this is what I want you to do. I'm not going to hold the scheduling conference because my topmost job is to be a case manager right now. I'm going to ask you to go out. I want you to describe every category of electronic information that is available. I want the plaintiff to figure out what it is that he needs. If you object to it, then what I think you need to do is move for a protective order with an affidavit setting forth cost, burden, and explaining to me why it is so hard. And then if you want it so badly, you're just going to have to come back to me with your own expert and tell me why it doesn't cost as much as they say or why it isn't so hard to gather, and then I'm going to do what I need to do. I'll rule on it as I always do.
So, Judge, do you like the idea of the 300 to 500 item spreadsheet with each one listed and Kevin checking off whether he wants it and Alvin checking off whether he fights it and the cost item right down the line?
I don't know another way to do it right now, because what we do is, or what I want you to do is figure out what you really need, and then I'm going to do basically what I do in every single discovery dispute, and I don't see this as so fundamentally different. I'm going to decide what you need to produce, what's relevant, and I'm going to decide whether it's worth the cost. I'm going to do some proportionality analysis, so I'm going to want the plaintiff to explain why he thinks it's likely he's going to find information there, and I want the defendant to tell me how much it's going to cost, and I'll make those balancing.
I was just asked that the court appreciate the fundamental difference in resources of the sides and perhaps require the defendant to provide its analysis before it requires the plaintiff to produce an expert, which is going to cost perhaps half the value of the case.
And he goes to for a protective order. He comes first. But I'll need something. If he tells me it's going to take... It's going to cost $1,000 a backup sheet, and it's going to take hours and hours and hours and close down the company. You've got to come up with a counterargument as to why you think it's reasonably likely you're going to find information that's essential to your case.
And I think, Your Honor, we probably would also give you a statistical analysis showing that even after expending all that time and all that effort, there's only a 1 or 2% likelihood that anything relevant to what he's talking about would be found.
And in the meantime, what I want to happen is everything that's easily producible should be produced forthwith. Have you already done that?
Well, I'm sure we have.
And, you know, burdens on plaintiffs, too.
Yeah, we need 30 more days.
John Jessen here was suggesting a statistical approach. We've got 1,000 backup tapes, one for each day for the last 3-plus years. And he's suggesting that instead of having to work all of them over, he just takes a sampling of them. What's your percentage, John? How many would you suggest to the judge would be an appropriate sample?
Well, the data will speak for itself. So it's a random sampling based on statistics, and it will yield true numbers. We have found, though, if you take the 3 years, same system backed up routinely for 3 years, and you have 1,000 tapes, you will find, and we have found over the last decade of doing this, that somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 30 tapes would probably generate over 95% of the data. I've seen it as high as 98% of the data. In my opinion, that would be pulling that set and restoring it and searching it and producing would be a reasonable thing to do. Not barring the other side from all the rest of the data, but putting the cost burden for the restoration and reading of the balance of the tapes, the other 970 tapes, on their shoulders if they want that additional 2, 3, 4, 5% of data. Those are the types of cost shifting that we're seeing starting to take place that I think make a lot of sense.
Okay. Steve Hunt. You come at this from a prosecutor's point of view. When you want data from a company, when you want data from the other side, give me your approach to how you think in terms of the scope of what you look for and ideas about proportionality and cost and imposition on your opponent.
Well, it really depends a great deal on the kind of case. There's a certain class of cases that are very much like this case that we've just been discussing, where there would be a, for example, a healthcare fraud case where we're trying to determine whether or not there was false billings to the Medicare program. Under those kind of things, our costs of analysis are very much like the corporation's cost of producing the material. The material doesn't do us any good unless we look at it. We talked here about statistical sampling. Another thing we frequently do is we actually pick a day or a topic, and we go through every piece of data that relates to that particular topic, trying to identify which of the list of the 300 to 500 we then want everything from. But we would worry about the fact that what we really wanted was that one piece of email that was floating around or that one draft document that was floating around that may happen to be in that 5% that don't get picked up. A second thing we do that raises problems is that we, this is not something we, I should take a step back, we aren't frequently in a situation where we're simply responding to a discovery request or making a discovery request. We're going in with a search warrant. We're going in with an order from a judge that says that we can take certain information because we want to get it before it gets destroyed. That has major business implications as we move from personal computers to business computers, because we don't have the ability to conduct these very complicated analyses we were just talking about here with sitting there. We need to take all of the equipment, we need to take all of the drives, and that has an enormous effect on the businesses, or more and more recently, the people with whom we are trying to get our information, because they are losing, for a period of time, their ability to conduct business. Finally, is that on the criminal side, our biggest issue on the horizon is one of whether or not we're going to continue to be able to get access to information. The information is becoming increasingly encrypted, and that raises a fundamental question as to whether or not we are going to get access to it. All of this discussion about a civil case presumes that you're eventually getting the material in plain text, that you have a right to get it in plain text. That is not clear in the criminal side, and there are Fifth Amendment issues that get in the way of getting it there.
Terry Lesner, would you describe from your point of view how what you look for when you come at a case where you suspect there's something on somebody's hard drive that you're wanting for an investigation?
Well, there are two general areas where we would be involved. One would be if we were doing something like an internal corporate investigation where there's been suspicion of inappropriate behavior by an officer or an employee, and we would be doing a midnight raid on that person's premises and downloading the hard drive from the computer to be imaged and then analyzed by us at a different location. Obviously, that's corporate property, so the corporation has the right to access that particular computer. The other thing we'd be doing would be a more of a computer investigative effort, which would be using the computer to conduct an inquiry, an investigation itself on the internet, trying to develop information to be used in litigation for, say, enjoining improper communications from short sellers and broker dealers and market manipulation. Now, we may be doing, recently we've been doing pre-complaint interviews of employees of a company where the previous managers had allegedly misappropriated substantial sums of money. And in those interviews, we've discovered a number of computer-related issues in terms of how the computers were used at the company and the use of a personal computer by a former employee who took the computer with him when he left, which contained substantial amounts of proprietary and confidential information that belonged to our client.
So let me ask the panel generally, are there any forms of digital information that you would consider beyond the bounds of civil discovery?
I would say one thing with voicemail, I'm not saying it's out of bounds, but that brings in a whole other area as far as retrieving that and also providing that in a way that's that you're able to read is another one. So I'm not saying that's out of bounds, but that's one that's more difficult as far as analysis and also production.
So voicemail presents different problems. Problems in terms of but it all just comes down to cost. It's just more difficult.
The cost and resources, I think the ability in that case to determine whose voice is what. And therefore it's one of those things you get what you ask for. So getting back to Tom or Kevin, if Kevin's going to go ahead and ask for a voicemail, he's going to get it, and he's going to spend the time to do it. So I just say to those, it's a little bit more complex, but yeah, probably right, cost and resources.
Tom, any categories out of bounds as far as you're concerned?
Are you talking about what the intention is under the rules or just common sense categories?
Talk to me both ways.
Okay. I contend that the rules do not contemplate, for example, the deleted information that is deliberately deleted on the part of the person pursuant to a neutral policy. I don't think the rules were intended to stretch that far. That's a whole category that I think is not intended to be covered.
So, for instance, Kevin wouldn't get deleted emails?
No, he would not routinely. And I don't think that's what he meant when he filed his initial request or wrote me his initial letter. I don't think he meant that he intended that. And that's not the way I read it. And that's not the way it should be read, in my view.
So that sounds like you wouldn't give him deleted emails.
And he shouldn't get them, in my view.
Judge.
Well, first of all, I disagree that they're not subject to the discovery rules, because I think by the plain terms that they are subject to the discovery rules. The question is, now to talk to your kids, everyone communicates by email. The email, people don't even make phone calls anymore. There are whole organizations that run through email. It is one of the primary methods of communication. So that, for example, in an employment discrimination case, one could well imagine that a lot of the discussions about keeping a person or firing a person are going to be over the email. That is going to be reasonably related to the case, and it's going to be discoverable because the tapes are kept in the ordinary course of business. That's why you're keeping them as backup. Now, the expense is different, burden is different, and privilege is different, because there are all sorts of things that are maybe private or privileged as an attorney client or work product doctrine. What's very hard is to try to figure out how to get to a plaintiff or a defendant the relevant non-privileged information without actually invading that privilege. Because I think many offices as well as many homes, people use the email interchangeably for personal as well as business reasons. And one of the issues that often comes up even in the criminal context is how do you review them in a way that doesn't unnecessarily infringe on someone's privacy rights, and yet get at what you really need and what's relevant to the litigation. That's a challenge for all of us.
Just let me ask you, as far as like the paper wastebasket kind of scenario and analogy there, if the idea, again, was intent was to delete that email so basically it's in the wastebasket, it's getting disposed of,
is the same duty that I would have to go ahead and go to my trash can and now retrieve documents that I thought I threw away, and that trash gets picked up, let's say, every week or something like that. Because I think that's analogy, it's kind of an analogy that we said about when I'm trying to do an email. And really, my intent is to delete it, it's wasted now, it's gone. But I need to retrieve it because electronic is available. But I need to do the same thing as far as going into my trash can.
I think it's reasonably within your control. There's some similar legal standards like that. So if the trash is still at the plant.
So I would have the duty to go into the...
If it's not there, you can't do the impossible. But in fact, a company gives with one, and you delete with one hand and preserve with another, and that's the dilemma that businesses are finding themselves in. I just learned a few months ago that delete doesn't mean delete. I imagine a lot of employees don't know that, and that's the dilemma, because it doesn't, as I understand it. It means it's there in the company in a retrievable form, and that's the problem.
From an investigative standpoint, when we're looking for potentially improper behavior, the first search we do once we've imaged the hard drive is we look for portions of the hard drive that have been deleted, because in our case we're assuming that the intent was perhaps to conceal incriminating information or evidence, and so it's important for us to know when it was deleted, and then to try to bring it back, assuming it hasn't been overwritten to the point where it's totally illegible, because that's where generally we find the best, most incriminating information.
That's where the good stuff is.
That's where the good stuff is. On the issue of privacy, we've discovered that's a very, very difficult situation. Even in the midnight raid, if you run across a home page, what is the answer? If you're talking about you're accessing a corporate computer, and up comes a home page, is that intended to be protected from incursion by an outsider, even though it's on a corporate computer? In a current situation that I referred to earlier, we have allegedly private material alongside our material belonging to our corporate client. Their position is, we'll allow you to access the corporate information after you destroy, not delete, but destroy anything that's on the computer that's personal, and we'll designate that. Well, technically, if we start to destroy large amounts of personal information, it's going to destroy our information as well. So I think it's the same question the judge was referring to, and that is, how do you examine this, and if you sat there and tried to examine it image by image to determine what was personal, what wasn't, you'd be there for 30 to 40 hours.
John Jensen, tell us how you do it. How would you do it? You've got material on a corporate machine that's both personal and corporate, and you don't want to give the personal stuff over. How do you do it?
Well, at the most fundamental level, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, there's no personal information on the corporate machine, by definition. So that's a whole other discussion. But I would take that stand, number one. But a good way to do it are things like search terms. If you develop a meet and confer early on is a good way, I think, in making the parties come together and meet and confer about methodology, how they're going, scope and proportionality, methodology are all good things to talk about, and things like search terms. So if you come up with a search term list relevant to that particular action and run it through blindly, you can run that through a piece of media, and it's only going to pull back the quote-unquote hit documents, the likelihood of one of those being what we're calling a personal document, I think, would be very low. And if it does contain those hits, it's not a personal document. I mean, it clearly enters into the arena of being relevant or potentially relevant. So one good way to do this more quickly, more efficiently, and yet preserve as much protection as you can would be things like using search terms through a piece of media.
Steve, you have something, and then I want to go to Tanya with our online group.
I was just going to take, so I'd like to address that too. I was just going to take one step farther back from Terry, who I was concerned seemed a little bit too adversarial in this. If, whether it's the civil context or the criminal context, the fundamental question is, what is the purpose of this venture? Is the purpose of the venture to find out what factually occurred? If the purpose of the venture is what factually occurred, whether or not it was thrown in a wastebasket or not is irrelevant. You then add the series of overlays that Judge Sarris talked about is it, at what price are we willing to pay for 100% certainty as to what happened? Are we happy with 98% certainty? Are there privileges? Are we simply going to not be, we want to have certain things private? But if the fundamental question is what happened, then whether it's deleted or not, whether it was intended to be deleted is relevant. You're trying to get the facts. The second thing, just to address the search terms, when I mentioned in the beginning that the court authorized wiretap of the computer network here at Hartford, it was on a network that had, over the course of the wiretap, a couple million emails go through the system. It also hosted internet relay chat and other things. And the way we were able to locate the intruder that was using Harvard as an attack point for military bases was to use an analysis that involved a series of search terms looking for keywords and able to isolate him that way. The problem is that it isn't foolproof in lots of ways. Proof in that particular case, extremely effective. But for example, he was dumping a lot of his programs into a file called text. It would not have, the way we were analyzing it, would not have separated the very private communication with the parent, data, slunk my test, from this computer program called test. So search engines, just like the internet, are good ways of getting basic information, of being able to isolate things, but they are only as good as the most powerful search engines on the internet, which I know we've all used and end up with files that were completely unrelated to what we wanted, and in some cases, not finding what we knew was out there that was related to what we wanted.
Well, I would just say that that's a very important point to make, because a lot of this boils down to the knowledge and the technology of the practitioner. There are ways, and there are very sophisticated ways, to do multiple searches, do Venn diagramming of search results and things, where you should not have had the test as a file lumped with test as a flunk the test. You know. So one of the things that we see is education about concepts and tools and methodologies, because there are ways to involve things like searches in ways that are actually far more accurate statistically and scientifically than a human search could be. And the problem is 30 to 40 hours was mentioned for sitting there as a human looking through a hard drive. I would say that would get you through maybe the boot sector of the hard drive if you really wanted to look at it. The problem is you could spend 3,000 to 4,000 hours if you really wanted to on a single hard drive as a human trying to interpret all that's going on. So you have to involve electronic mechanisms in this process, and you need to do it in an intelligent way.
So just to wrap up this segment, the picture that seems to be emerging is that somewhere in this initial process of conference, there's going to evolve, at least in the sophisticated case, some kind of agreement or ruling on methodology of search and scope of search. And these methodologies and scope questions sound like they're deeply sophisticated. How are you going to do that? How is that going to work from your point of view?
Now, that's interesting. We were talking about this before a little bit. Some of us are extremely sophisticated in computers, but not most of us. Some judges have never turned on a computer. Most judges, know, like myself, probably fall in the middle range. I think to the extent that it can't be agreed upon, what we will do is what we do in patent cases and all sorts of sophisticated science cases, is we might even have to hold a hearing and have experts talk to us about what makes sense and what's reasonable. one possibility, which I've never done in the discovery context because the expense is so overwhelming, but in a big case maybe be appropriate, would be to hire a court-appointed expert to help me walk through what is reasonable in any given situation. That is happening increasingly in both the Daubert area as well as the science area as well as in the patent area. I hope we don't get to that because the whole thrust of where discovery is going is trying to make it cheaper and not more expensive. But as it gets more and more sophisticated, if I have dueling experts, I may well want to say to the parties, I want to hire my own person.
Tanya, what have we got from our online group?
Hello. Mark Herlihy asks, what do we do with documents that formerly weren't preserved? Are those documents types of documents we want to have presumptively included or excluded from discovery requests? And if we want to include them, how can the requester incorporate such documents into the discovery request?
Documents that were formally not preserved.
Which is, I think, to say things that haven't traditionally been part of maintained files. So overwritten documents, deleted documents, exactly the types of things that are that one, you know, the most complicated things to retrieve in a search, and perhaps also the most expensive.
One thing jumps to mind, for example, let's take it a simple email system. Common email systems, you have the email message, but there are traditionally, usually, hundreds of data elements about that email. That's not stuff that was either traditionally preserved, and certainly you couldn't have preserved it, all that metadata, it's called, in a paper setting. And yet, for each piece of email, there could be a corresponding set of one mainframe mail program or more of over 600 different little pieces of data. When it was sent, was it ever opened, when it was opened, how it traveled, I mean, tremendous amounts of data carried with documents today. That's sort of a non-traditional data set. And the answer is electronic data files, without exception, an electronic data file contains more information than you could ever put in paper format. And so electronic data, by its very nature, carries with it far more information than any traditional document ever does. That's the whole point of electronic discovery, is seeking out and getting access to that information. And again, a good process will do that, and it will do it with very little overhead as compared to reading the text of the document itself. I want to make one point about hearing the sophisticated case issue coming up. And there's sort of, it seems to me there's this indication that it has to be a big case to warrant proper electronic discovery. And I take issue with that. We see a tremendous number of what would normally be called small cases, an individual suing a company, or a slip and fall type case, something that normally wouldn't rise to the dollar value that anyone here would consider a big case. And yet, those are very important cases to consider for electronic discovery. Because of the reciprocity issue, the amount of data on one side or the other. And so we see electronic data being brought into all cases, regardless of the monetary size of the case.
What do you mean by the reciprocity issue again?
An individual suing a company over an improper dismissal, for example, may not even have a computer other than their work computer. They don't have one at home. Or if they do have one at home, there's probably very little showing that has relevant information. So here you've got a situation where the one side has little or no electronic discovery burden. Yet on the other side, by virtue of being a large organization, for example, a tremendous amount of electronic data exists simply by being in business. And if not, if decisions aren't made properly, then any decision about electronic data, you know, could be case-altering. We had a judge, a case where one employee was able to force a company to look at 10,000 backup tapes, and each tape had 70 gigabytes of electronic data, of email. Well, that ends that case, because the cost of looking at 10,000 70-gigabyte DLT tapes is probably $10 million. That case was in the $80,000 range originally. So the reciprocity issue is a very important one. It also it goes with the proportionality issue. Who has what data, what the whole thing is worth. For 80,000, should you have to look at $10 million worth of data, and those types of issues.
One of the major questions that's come up is if the goal of the problem with digital discovery is cost, is the major mitigating factor, then if we could find a way to reduce cost, would people here be comfortable then with no inherent limits, no presumptive exclusions from the discovery request? And for the people with information management expertise, what are the ways of reducing the cost?
I guess I'm going to go ahead and come back to a certain issue we brought before. This whole thing about search terms. Kevin started off by saying, well, now that a big company like DuPont is in the information age, we should easily and without much cost be able to retrieve all this information. Well, there's no agreement in terms of keyword searching, and really that doesn't mean that I've got any more benefit and I can reduce my cost. So this issue that was brought up about negotiating up front about keywords allows me to make use of the information I have in a way that sounds better information, therefore less costly. I'm very process improvement oriented regarding this. So that's one. The backup tapes, again, is though, again, that same issue. And there is an understanding that that's deleted information that really is there for disaster recovery purposes, and that agreement that Tom brought up is made, then that will reduce the cost. That's where it really comes into play for us here.
Anyone else on this one?
I think I'd argue that if you reduce the cost and expand discovery even further into these areas that have been referenced, you're going to have a huge impact on corporate behavior. Because if I'm running a corporation and I'm told that everything's discoverable and the backup tapes are discoverable, I'm going to institute a new document destruction program and computer destruction program or destruction of information. I'm simply going to rearrange my operations so that I keep essential data necessary for operations and taxes, but it's going to be minimal. And I'm not going to have things on the server. I'm going to clean the server much more frequently than I do now. And it's not only going to hurt civil litigation, ultimately, to go that route, but it's going to hurt what Stephen does, because when he goes into a corporation that's had this cleansing review, there's going to be significantly less information for him to look at.
Charlie, can I follow up on that?
Well, let me just see if I can pose it a little more sharply. I'm the CEO of Megacorp, and I've just heard that all of this stuff is discoverable. I've just read that the White House is in trouble with email. I've just seen Bill Gates just posed with a bunch of email. I come to you, Tom, and I say, you're my general counsel. And I've got a recommendation from Lenzner that says we ought to institute a document retention program that gets rid of all this stuff. What do you tell me?
Well, this is the point I wanted to make. There's something to what Terry says, but I think it points up a different point, and that is this, that when, as the judge pointed out, the federal rules talk in terms of things which are in the possession, custody, and control of a party. If we take the unequivocal position that every single thing that's within our possession, control, and custody is discoverable automatically without anything more showing, and it's just a question of cost, you're throwing away, to me, an important balancing question. Let me give you an example. Someone picks up the telephone and calls a friend. They complete that telephone conversation, they hang it up. That conversation is gone. In today's world, the email is the same as a telephone conversation. When the person hangs up the email and deletes it, that conversation is gone. There's a risk that by telling people that cannot be the way you use your email system, you're going to destroy the productivity increases that are really driving this country today. And what I resent is the implication in some of these cases that I've read, particularly there's one in the district court in Illinois, where the court said, look, when a corporation put this system into place, they must have understood that the consequences of having these systems were they're going to have to produce everything that it generates. And I say that's not a fair thing to say. I say that the that the corporations of America and the individuals around this table and those of us who use emails every day are doing this for really what is a good societal purpose, and that is to increase our general awareness and productivity. And I think we all benefit from that. And I think it's a real danger to throw the baby out with the bathwater by saying that every single thing is therefore discoverable.
And when next year it turns out that your telephone calls are actually packet switched and all recorded, you're going to be in even worse trouble.
Yeah, but I would still say that the rule is, but the answer is not to be black or white. The answer is to have something that, as I suggested earlier, which is said that except for good cause shown, for example, the judge has mentioned employment cases where intent and motivation is crucial. Maybe in an employment case you have a different body of rules that develop than you do in a patent case, where intent is not quite so important, where it's more objective. I think these things can be ruled out, or I mean can be worked out, but I don't think that a blanket assertion that every single scrap of deleted information, even though it can be found somewhere, is discoverable as a matter of course.
Jim?
When I was on a flight from Philadelphia to Boston, I came up with a little creed here, the Electronic Discovery Manager creed, and to allow me, just there were three short ones. Number one, I believe a corporation has a responsibility to have an electronic discovery response plan. It should be incorporated with the process for responding to discovery requests. And that's what we came up with. Something simple as that. It's a process of which we can, it's a playbook that we can play B. Number two, the court should put some value on the fact that we have such a plan, that we're looking to. We realize our duty to go ahead and preserve and to respond to such requests. I believe the corporation has a responsibility to educate their employees on business writing. We talked about the Microsoft case, and a lot of that is what you might call bad eating, but that has to do with writing. Number four, I believe that the discovery process is often looking for needles in the haystack. Let's get to the cost issue. Data collection, processing, analysis, and production costs are my chief concern in my job. Most cases can come down to sometimes just 1,000 pages of key documents. So I believe there's too much hay in the haystacks. I believe a corporation should not be punished for reducing the haystacks with the accusation that you're trying to rid yourselves of prickly needles. And that's the one thing that we see with some of the cases, is that if you go ahead and start implementing a, say about a cleansing system here or whatever like that, really what you're trying to do is just have your corporate records program be a little bit more solid. The accusation can very easily come up that you're trying to get rid of the bad stuff. And that's why I think sometimes a corporation is frustrated in their attempts to go ahead and to come up with a cleansing system.
Jim?
Yeah, I'd just like to respond to that a little bit. I also believe the haystack is too big. I think corporations keep far too much. I think this is all part of the planning that is necessary to go along with the planning as to what they should keep for possible litigation in the future. You know, there is more to our judicial system than digital discovery. I mean, there's all sorts of other rules. You know, one rule, for example, is that negative inferences can be drawn from a corporation's failure to have certain documents. You know, I think this is constantly a balancing process. I think that Tom is right when he says that there should be a backdrop of common sense. And but I think judges need to educate themselves. They need to understand the basic vocabulary of what's going on here. And they must do just what they've always done, which is balance the relevance against issues such as cost and burdensome. And the more relevant, until it reaches the point of where a negative inference can be drawn, you know, those are the documents that need to be paid particular attention to. Plaintiffs don't want the haystack. That's the last thing they want. We don't get paid by the hour. We get paid when it's over. We want to end it. We're racing to get it over. It's always the race to get it over. We don't like documents. We like just a few documents. We don't like experts. We want to end the case. And and we're totally frustrated by corporations which have their own priorities, which aren't the plaintiff's priorities. It's their own. They've got to run this corporation. They've got to make chemicals. They've got to do what they've got to do, and they're not looking at litigation. But I think they need to look at that a little bit better than they have in the past. And I do think, to answer the question again, that if the cost is reduced, then there should be unlimited discovery. And I also think that most of that haystack should be gone by the time that decision is made by a judge.
I think to address costs in a way, we've talked about negative costs here mostly. And I would argue that
there's a positive side to cost. The real dichotomy with electronic discovery is that organizations that are not prepared to deal with electronic discovery in a sensible way are punished by this severely. It becomes a tremendous cost and burden. Yet we have seen organizations that get prepared for this. They know it's coming. They know they have to be involved in this modern world. They take the steps to cut costs, and I'll enumerate those in a second. But when in doing so, if you've done that, your cost actually drops dramatically. We're involved in a lot of second request kind of work. And I've seen electronic discovery that satisfies the FTC and the SEC electronically done at a hundredth or two hundredth the cost of paper discovery. We saw one recently, $6 million has been spent just duplicating paper so far, and the electronic counterpart was done for a couple hundred thousand. I mean, literally those kind of differentials. So it does behoove a company to address this. And you cut costs in two ways. You get rid of stuff, and you develop a records retention plan that addresses electronic data. And number two, you put mechanisms in place and response systems in place so that when you have to do it, you do it in a defensible way, a correct way. You do it in a timely way, and you do it in a cost-efficient way. So that's how you address it.
A lot of this is based on tradition. A lot of students here in Harvard will probably laugh at this, but it's true. A lot of the ways we handle this, talking about what John just said, you take electronic data, you take an email, and then what you do with it is you print it all out so you can review it. That's what you're used to. And then you're going to code it in the disk, so you're going to put that electronic form, so then you can print it out so that you can produce it. Just that process itself seems so inefficient, but I can tell you that more, I'm looking myself in the mirror. We've done that for a long time. So the ability to change that process, you can reduce your cost by having a response plan to address it.
I'd just like to address the haystack point, which is a good one. Most cases settle. Well over 90% of the cases go away before they hit trial, and the vast majority of those are through settlement rather than through dispositive motion. Right now, alternative dispute resolution is not mandatory, but it is required that every court make that an offering to the litigants. And what I'm seeing increasingly is structuring this whole process so that you get the 90% of the discovery right up front, either through document exchanges or through the automatic disclosure. You shoot in a key deposition or two, and then you try and settle the case. You don't have to go for that last 10%. It's going to be so costly or possibly so lucrative from the plaintiff's point of view in terms of finding the key document until you decide whether the case can settle or not. I think most of this is only, you say not the sophisticated case, I think you can eliminate a lot of the leverage, if that's the right word, that defendants sometimes feel like, oh, this is going to cost us so much money, or the plaintiff's worried about, oh, I have to hire a forensic computer expert. If you can get out 90% of this stuff right away and then enter into the mediation process, the odds are you're never going to hit that last 10%.
Let's talk for a minute about a real case, Northwest Airlines sued against the union for alleged sick-out. Who can tell me the facts of this case? John, can you describe this case?
You mean the non-lawyer, I bet you.
I'll tell you about it.
Over the holidays, particularly, Northwest Airlines felt that there was a higher sick leave, you know, being taken by attendants than was normal. And they claimed that there was bad faith on the union's part in organizing that and arranging for that and being involved in the communication of that. The union claimed that's not true. People were scared of Y2K and the flu was going around, and that's all there was to it.
And this was in the context of contract negotiation, broadly speaking.
Exactly. And what Northwest Airlines did is they went after the home computers of a lot of people, including not only union officials, but employees who were not decision makers in the union, but were just employees. And they found a lot of employees talking badly about the company, and I think over a dozen employees were eventually fired because of the information that Northwest Airlines did find on their computer systems and the email and the chat and the things that they were end up communicating with.
So they're looking for evidence that there's an organized sick out.
They're looking for communications between employees and union people that they would use as evidence of collusion to put together this organized sick out, as opposed to it being a random event because of Y2K and the flu. And what really made this an interesting case, and a very potent one, is this whole issue of seizing home computers, which is a dangerous thing to do. It puts a very slippery slope when you start allowing, you know, the seizure of home computers the way it was done in this case in a wholesale manner, and then turned over to a third party who did searching and things. So that, I think that's what makes this one really stand out, is just the sheer quantity and the nature of the seizure of those computers that took place.
They seized the home computers, they turned them over to a neutral third party.
Correct.
Who looked through whatever's on them.
They took the email and files, whatever was on there, and searched for evidence of that kind of communication.
So, what's the problem? Why is this any different from any other discovery request where you look for what's there? They were looking for relevant information, yes?
Well, a lot of the issues that came up had to do with overreaching. A lot of the employees that they looked at their mail were not union people or didn't have any role in influencing union decisions and things. So that's one of the issues that popped up. I agree. In many ways, that's the kind of information that you would need to have in order to prove that that type of collusion was taking place. So on that level, I fully support what took place. Personally, I have a little problem with involving home computers and things into the process that way. But in this case, where that's the mode where the communication was taking place, maybe that was the only way to do it. I don't have a full answer for it.
Let me add a few facts about that case that are kind of interesting. First, they didn't seize the computers. What happened was they brought suit in federal court. The federal judge determined that he did not have jurisdiction, so they brought suit in state court. And an order was issued, interestingly enough, requiring the defendants, or in this case the third-party persons who were the flight attendants, to bring their computers into Coopers & Lybrand, I think it was.
No, Urson.
Whatever they are in today's world.
Yeah.
And they then had a protocol. And the protocol set forth what they were allowed to look at and what they weren't allowed to look at. And it's a fascinating document if you've ever seen it. I have a copy of it. And so you have to trust the accountants not to look at whatever is personal on it. But the rumor I've heard, and maybe, John, you're the one that told me this, I've heard stories that has backfired on Northwest in the sense that they are now being sued over, those of us from the Midwest are rather conscious of the problems Northwest had with airplanes parked at and didn't get parked at Detroit last winter, and there's class actions, and apparently they've gone after the home computers of the executives of Northwest. It's kind of set a very bad reciprocity.
Yeah, as a corporate counselor, I would probably not have recommended that wholesale asking for computers, because they're going to have a hard time, and apparently are having a hard time defending themselves not now turning over. We call it distributed data, and it goes far beyond the home. I mean, it's home computer, it's your laptop, it's your Palm Pilot, very big today to get people's Palm Pilots. It's all that distributed data is now being brought into the whole pod.
It's a logical outcome, what we're talking about. I mean, logically, there's no difference.
Steve, do you have any reaction on the case?
I am offended by the privacy notion on this one. I mean, the computers. I mean, my own personal computer has my tax returns. It has private conversations going back and forth with my children. It has my entire life on it. And when you're seizing a small part, when what you're doing is getting access to a small part and absorbing the whole computer and giving it to somebody who's then going to look through it, and he's not going to just pick up the few things that are relevant. There's going to be lots of other parts of my life that are going to be there. And I've supervised enough electronic surveillance to know that the worst that there is yet to be, bear with me on this, it's really just a fictitious story, but there has yet to be a piece of electronic surveillance where somebody who's sitting with the headphones on for the 30th day in a row, and it's late Saturday night, and it's been a really slow day, and somebody starts talking to their girlfriend, And all of a sudden, you have 25 minutes worth of tape-recorded conversation with a girlfriend. That's what's going to happen when you seize computers and give them to third party. There will be something interesting in there that leaks out. And that is not, that is offensive to sensibilities. But it makes sense, and the whole process makes sense if what you're trying to do is get information with no other overlay in there. But once you start talking about privacy issues, and computers are all about intermingling private and personal, non-criminal and criminal, private and public, I'm a little bit less sanguine that a corporation has the right, particularly if they don't have a banner on their network, to go into anybody's computer and get anything they want to get. Once you're mixing all of that together, we've got to start importing into the discovery process, importing into civil and criminal procedure, a notion of privacy that is a first-level interface.
Kevin?
Just real quickly on that, I disagree. I believe it's discoverable. I think that our judicial system has dealt with problems like this for decades. It's a question of giving a computer to a judge in chambers or giving information in chambers where somebody in a sense of with a sense of authority is going to be distinguishing what's relevant and what's not relevant. I think there must be great caution as to how this is done, but I think it absolutely has to be done, because if you don't do that, then the system will crumble.
I'm with you 100%, but I have run into very few judges who are very happy with the idea of you're walking in with a computer and says, I've got 9.2 gigabytes of information here, and I know there's some private stuff in it, and there's some privileged stuff, but I'd like you to be the one who separates what's private and public. And I know that 9.2 gigabytes would fill this room with pieces of paper, but you've got lots of time, Judge, but that's what you're into.
Again, it's the balancing. With the common sense backdrop, you're balancing the importance against the cost, against the burdensomeness, with the backdrop of common sense. It's what judges do every day.
Judge.
Let me start off. I don't know this case, but what's surprising me the most is that here you're dealing with a non-party, which is an employee. You're not dealing with the union, which I'm assuming is the sole defendant. And usually with third parties, there's a deposition notice and a subpoena duke is taken, which says bring in the documents, and we trust the third person to bring in the relevant documents. In other words, the way it would normally work in the setting is that you expect the employee to be under an obligation to go through his or her personal computer and take out any relevant email. The equivalent of forcing them to bring in their computer is the equivalent of allowing Northwest to go through their personal file cabinet, if you want to go through the trash can analogy. So I'd love to know what persuaded the judge to actually require the personal computers to be brought in rather than to first go through the normal court. That's surprising. The second thing is there isn't going to be a judge who's going to sit there and say, wait a minute, 3,000 to 4,000 hours on a single hard drive to screen this information. We don't have the time, and if we did, we don't want to do it. So inevitably it becomes a cost factor again of hiring a firm or some independent master to go through them. But I'd like to know how that even happened in the first place.
This is a portion of it that comes up both in criminal and civil, which is the notion of the appropriate level of discovery, the appropriate level of burden between the parties and third parties, and the appropriate level of the presumption of privacy of third parties versus the principals. And here, it's just gone way outside, it seems to me, a boundary there, without first coming in and saying, this is what I would offer.
At least they used a third party. I think the only redeeming value out there is that they actually used an independent third party.
And the protocol was sensible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I would, with the right third party and the right rules in place and things, you're not going to have leakage. I think you're much more protected there than you are giving data like that to either party. I'd been much more uncomfortable if Northwest would have been able to go through those computers. So at least there was something in there that made sense.
You know what persuaded the judge not to go to normal court? Anyone?
Wasn't that, it was a mediator that eventually ordered it to happen. The mediator told the judge they didn't have jurisdiction. And that's who made
it happen. No, the United States Mediation Service told the federal judge
that he didn't have
jurisdiction. Then they immediately went to a state court, and it was a litigated issue. I've only read the public record. There's no indication on the public record. The court just signed it. No.
I can't help when John was telling the story. I was thinking about a girl that's your Ford Motor Company deal with the program.
I didn't hear you, Jim.
I'm sorry. The Ford Motor Company, I think I have the right car manufacturer, came out with a program where employees could buy computers for like $10 a month, and then they'd be home computers, and they could be used for business and personal purposes as well. But I mean, the PR, of course, employee relations issue, that's why I say it's jeopardized, because now employees are going to think, well, I'm being set up. You know, I'm being used for monitoring purposes, and I can get that. So I just think that employee relations person, a public relations issue, that's looking from that perspective.
There has been some things written about the Northwest case that it indeed has had a chilling effect on employee communication. There's been a huge huge decrease in employee communication over mail, first. And second, a lot more anonymity, a lot more, you know, things taken to hide information. So it did have a chilling effect on communication.
Hi, have we got any curiosity in our online group?
We do. Two questions right now. One actually referring to an older conversation, and one about privacy in this conversation. So I guess to keep it relevant, if Judge Sarris's analogy on privacy is accurate, what are the implications of this new method of discovery on our conceptions of privacy? Does the privacy itself need to change? The conceptions of privacy need to change? Does the media need to change? Does the scope of discovery need to be altered?
Let me see I was working with that a little bit with Tom when he's talking about email and telephone. And one can see the technology changing so the things we used to think of as private are now recorded. And it's getting close to the point where almost everything we do is recorded. And so the question is, do we need to reconceive our notions of privacy so it's like the forget it, it's gone approach to privacy? Or do we somehow need to reconceptualize the law to protect our privacy, even in situations where it's not possible to discover what used to be thrown out of trash?
Well, I think privacy is a pretty well-established and elastic concept in the law. I think that you can build in concepts even under the plain discovery rubric of what's relevant and what's too private to be revealing. I'm not sure exactly what the person who's asked this question has said, but the balancing that you would normally go through it would apply to the privacy concept. If somebody is talking to their girlfriend over the internet in an email, I don't see why that should be discoverable simply because it's on your computer. Now, I'm not sure what beyond that he's trying to say.
Thanks much. I guess one thing just about this issue always seems to come up with electronic discovery. I guess the prevailing rule, John, you can tell me if it's changed, but with an email policy for a corporation or internet policy is two simple phrases. Business has the right to review and use for business purposes only. And I know that's part of our email policy, and then you get into the issue, well, are the employees, do they sign off on such a thing? I know for us, we have a business ethics policy, we sign off on a year every year, that's included as part of the sign off. Are there reminders about that policy? Every time we log into the system, we get that simple little citation that's for business purposes, employee has the right to review. So the question I'd always say about the privacy, though, and this is, I think, what's changing, is do I need to notify someone if there is a claim, let's say it's a claim brought up by an employee in my company, and I want to go ahead and search their email. Should I notify them? I'm going to need to do something like that. And that's a question we're going to throw out.
Well, but it also, I just want to say, it comes in not just in the business context. Sure, I understand that, but when you're starting to grab home computers, or you're starting to have communication by people outside of the corporation who aren't familiar with this particular policy, I think it's not a clear waiver situation.
Charlie, I think this affects something to the same set of events, which is that you can either have the law adapt to the technology. Here, we start off by talking about imposing new rules on what you ought to be able to get by way of discovery because of cost burdens that would come into the system. Or you can have the technology change in response to these new pressures on the law. For example, corporations confronted with massive amounts of discovery costs all of a sudden start investing in software that make it much easier, which lowers the cost of discovery. The same thing happens with privacy. It's all moving very quickly. Right now, there's an issue, all of a sudden you talk about packet switching on telephone networks, making it easier to record telephone calls, you've got emails. On the other hand, in a few years, encryption will be ubiquitous and it'll be private again. It's a tension between whether or not you want to try to change the law to adjust to fast-moving technology, whether you want to let the market system and people's understanding of technology react to the law as it is, or some combination of the two, and if it's a combination of the two, how best to figure out what the appropriate balance is. I'm worried about arguments that sound like this is the way that America becomes great, our financial system is wonderful, because it's unfounded in economics. We don't have a mathematical model for it. There's also a short-term fairness problem. There is huge demand of dollars, but it is fundamentally a short-term problem of fairness.
Say, two students who've been sitting so patiently here, I'd love to recognize you if there are some questions that any of you might have for our panelists. And Ken Wickers, likewise, love to get you into it. Hold on, yeah.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Kilman. I'm a third-year law student here at the law school, and I'm in the Exploding Internet class. So my question sort of springs from the Northwest Airlines case, and I was thinking about the fact that the law firm I'm going to work for next year is buying or paying for me to buy a computer. So they're giving me money as a reimbursement for a computer which I'll keep in my home. Then I expected, until today, that I would probably also use it for personal use, and that would allow me to, you know, use email and things like that, and that I wouldn't also have to go buy myself another computer for personal use. But in light of the Northwest case, I'm worried that maybe not Skadden, but let's say I were working for an airline company or some other corporation, and all of a sudden Discovery pops up for all of their computers, is that going to extend to the computer I've got at home because they paid for it and I've sometimes used it for work-related issues?
The fact that they paid for it brings us certainly much more into the scope. But I'd argue it didn't matter who paid for it, if it's shown that you were doing work on it, that's relative to the situation at hand. I've been involved in many cases over the years where the equipment had nothing to do with the company. It was owned by the individual. Depositions or other information came to light to show that it was reasonably believed that there was information on that home system that was important, that was unique, and that might be in jeopardy if notice was given. And I've seen ex parte orders granted, indeed been involved in them, and to go into private homes and take these computers away. So yeah, the trouble is we're getting into a gray area. If the company owns the computer, there's no such thing as privacy. And this has been litigated over and over and over again. I mean, the most recent case, if I remember the facts properly, the public case is Pillsbury, had a privacy policy that they gave to employees that they wouldn't read their email. They voluntarily gave that. They were sued. They had to go through their email for purposes of litigation. Were sued by the employees saying, you're violating the privacy you gave us, and Pillsbury won. That's how strong their right is to use their information on systems they're paying for. The trouble is when you start commingling privately owned assets with corporate data, and that's a good question to bring to the employer. These are my assets. I'm paying for those. You're asking me to do homework on those, and I'm going to commingle private and business information. What's up? You know, are you gonna? Yeah. How does this impact me as an employee? I think those are questions that'll start being asked or should be asked.
I think there are some jurisdictions that have held that if the employee demonstrates that he intends this to be a home page solely for his own personal use, that would be protected. Even if it's a corporate computer. I don't think all jurisdictions hold that, but there's a bigger issue here, Charlie. I think in the privacy area, a lot of the future of this whole means of communication is going to depend upon people's confidence in privacy. I don't mean just home computers, but the whole vehicle of communication. Many of these chat sites that people use and communicate on, there's an anticipation of privacy. The people that establish the website say, you can come on here using a pseudonym. And my prediction is there's going to be a gigantic battle between people who are being victimized by pseudonyms and their right to privacy versus the kind of injuries that companies and other people are going to suffer. And I think there's going to, judges are going to have to balance that. One of the questions I would have asked in the, if I'd been in front of the Northwest Court was, is there other alternative ways to gather the same information without seizing home computers and potentially embarrassing the owner, plus creating a chilling effect on the use of home computers at all? Are there alternative discovery ways or investigative ways or research ways to have gathered the same information?
Patricia.
Hi. Actually, I have a related question. My name is Patricia, and I'm a second-year student here. Technically speaking, is it possible to organize the files in such a way that we designate an area of the hard drive to only personal use and an area that's only private use, to the extent that we can sort of, before we get to this stage, have the nature of it already structured in such a way that when we come to the litigation point, it's not as technically impossible or costly? Is that technically possible?
Well, I can speak to that in a couple ways. Sure, it's technically possible. The trouble is it goes to human, you know, frailty and good faith issues and things. You know, it's like going through a filing cabinet and you have a yellow folder and you say, oh, don't look in that yellow folder, that's all my personal stuff. You know, it goes
like Mark attorney client privilege or something.
Yeah, it goes back to how much you trust the fact that what's been dropped into that bucket called personal really is, which is, again, I go back to using technology. Technology is blind. I can search a computer very quickly and more accurately than a human could in a way that no person ever sees content. And the only thing that flows from that search are those items, not necessarily files, because it could be fragments of deleted data, it could be email, which aren't technically files. It could be files. We call them items. The only items that flow from that are those that have met the requirements of the search. Then you don't have to worry about where it really is, because a personal document that meets all of that search criteria, or you know, some level of it, is an interesting document, whether you call it personal or not. So yes, technically you can segregate things, but I see that having very little impact in reality in terms of discovery.
Last comment from Kevin.
Yeah, I would just like to say that if I were to give you advice, my advice would be to both of you who asked those questions, that in discovery, generally, anything is discoverable unless the as long as it's relevant, and unless there's some exception, like evidence, as Charlie knows best of all. Everything's admissible unless there's some reason why it can't be admitted. And my advice is caveat user of electronic equipment, especially in these days where things are commingled to an extent that we have not addressed before. So be careful.
Well, in its way, caveat user is what this whole subject is about. That is, we've rushed as a society into the electronic environment, and we're only now coming to terms with how different that environment actually is. In many different ways, our expectations, our legal rules, our practices, our legal practices. There are so many wonderful questions that are raised by it that I hope that it's a subject that we can explore further. For purposes of our online audience, we are going to initiate a threaded discussion that allows this conversation to continue. There are many questions that we didn't get to that we will post in connection with this. I thank you all very much for participating. I thank students here for coming as well. And I thank the online audience for your participation. So with that, let me ask Talia if just one moment.
I'd like, before I close, though, to say a special thank you to Ben Edelman. Could we put Ben Edelman on the camera just so people can take a look at him? Ben is the tech guru of the Berkman Center. He is responsible for the webcasting that we do and for a lot of technical architecture of our thought process at the center. So thank you very much, Ben, for all of your great work on this. Thank you all, and good afternoon. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
What I'm talking about is the deleted files. What I'm talking about is when you're going into somebody in your company's computer, you suspect that something's not proper behavior.
Yeah,
first person will look at it. I mean, first person will look at the deleted files.
Sure.
Because he's probably trying to hide the...
And that's perfectly appropriate. And I would argue that that's what I'm trying to do.
That would be
that's a good
part.
Reason.
That would be good.
Right.
I'm looking forward to talking to somebody who's at the other end.
What do they have to get on this?
How much?
Nice meeting you.
$56?
Okay.